From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
What we're also going to see, that this will be the great test, to watch the front page of the New York Times and Washington Post. If the inspectors don't find weapons of mass destruction, if they are not hindered in their work, I suspect we're going to see stories which begin to hint that the inspectors are not quite up to the job, that they don't really have the abilities or the technical competence to fulfill the job properly. So the moment the smears began against the UN inspectors, if they do begin, then we'll know America is about to go to war.
Today, we'll spend the hour with Robert Fisk, the Beirut-based foreign correspondent for the Independent newspaper. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. By a 90-9 vote, the Senate voted yesterday to establish a Department of Homeland Security to oversee the largest reorganization of the federal government in 50 years. The department will merge 22 agencies, including the Coast Guard, the Secret Service, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and Border Control. With 170,000 employees, it will become the government's third largest unit behind the Pentagon and Department of Veteran Affairs. Bush administration officials acknowledge that the merger could take years and may put the country at increased risk of attack if the reorganization does not go smoothly. Despite union opposition, Bush won broad powers to hire, fire, and reassign workers within the department. The bill calls for the development of a total information awareness program to monitor the public's internet usage, banking transactions, travel arrangements, among other things. The leading critic of the department, Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia, said, quote, "This Senate has come close to building a massive chamber of secrets." Added at the last minute to the House version of the bill were several pro-business amendments, including one that would retroactively protect pharmaceutical firms from lawsuits. One such lawsuit was filed against Eli Lilly by parents who blame its vaccine on causing autism in their child. Eli Lilly has close ties to the Republican leadership. The firm was the industry's largest contributor to the GOP this year, and White House Budget Director Mitch Daniels used to be the company's president of North American operations. Companies that provide airport security and develop anti-terrorism technologies will also be protected from lawsuits. Three Democrats and three moderate Republicans say they were persuaded to vote the president's way after the Republicans promised to alter three of the most bitterly contested provisions early next year. The three provisions would establish a university research center for domestic security, most probably at Texas A&M University, would allow many businesses that have left the country to avoid federal taxes to contract with the new department, and would provide legal protection to companies that make ingredients for vaccines. The department will also be exempted from major provisions of the Freedom of Information Act. Private corporations that share information with the government will also be shielded. The nine senators who voted against the bill on final passage were Democrats Robert Byrd of West Virginia, Paul Sarbanes of Maryland, Hawaii Senators Daniel Akaka and Inouye, Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy, Russell Feingold of Wisconsin, Ernest Hollings of South Carolina, and Carl Levin of Michigan. Independent James Jeffords of Vermont also voted against the bill. The Senate's newest member, Independent Dean Barkley of Minnesota, acknowledged he voted with the Republicans after he was promised that millions of dollars in fines for violating welfare laws would be waived for his home state. The Washington Post reports the Bush administration has begun soliciting support from allies for contributions of personnel and equipment to assist the U.S. forces in invading Iraq. U.S. embassies in 50 countries have been told to sound out foreign leaders about their willingness to participate in military action in the event Saddam Hussein fails to comply with a new U.N. resolution requiring Iraq to fully disarm and open its chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons facilities to inspection. And in Alabama, environmental and civil rights groups filed a federal lawsuit lawsuit to block the army from burning tons of chemical weapons, including old shells containing nerve gas and mustard gas. The incineration is planned to begin early next year in the city of Anniston outside Birmingham. To calm residents, city officials have said they plan to pass out gas masks and duct tape to seal homes. Somebody shut up. You are listening to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Senior Iraqi officials told Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix Iraq will give full cooperation and full transparency to inspectors searching for weapons of mass destruction. Iraq also intends to meet the UN's December 8th deadline and make a full declaration of all material it holds relating to chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, the Bush administration continues to insist Iraq is already violating the Security Council resolution by firing on U.S. and British aircraft over the U.S. and British imposed no-fly zones. But in a rare rebuke to Washington, U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan adamantly told reporters the anti-aircraft fire does not breach the resolution. Today on Democracy Now!, we'll spend the hour with maverick journalist Robert Fisk. He's the Middle East correspondent for the British Daily The Independent, and has been based in Beirut, Lebanon for 26 years. He joined us in our Firehouse studio yesterday afternoon. I asked him to start off by commenting on the Bush administration's insistence that Iraq is violating the UN resolution.
Well, the British and American aircraft flying over Iraq are not there on the basis of any UN resolution. Furthermore, if they were, it would surely be up to the UN Security Council to rule whether this is a breach of the resolution or not. This is a further example of using the UN when it's of use, but overriding them and making our own judgments when it's not necessary to do so. In a sense, this is actually, I think, what Bush has done all along. First of all, he went to the UN General Assembly on the 12th of September, where I had the privilege of sitting there and watching him. I've actually never seen him before. I want to have a look at him. And when he said, either the UN is going to come in and do its job and stand up to this tyrant, or it's going to be like the League of Nations, forgetting that the League of Nations, which was founded effectively by American President Woodrow Wilson, was eventually turned to debris, in the words of one of its council leaders, Eamon de Valera, because major powers decided to do what they wanted, whatever the League thought. In other words, the pressures upon the UN now are very similar to those put upon the League of Nations. The pressures that destroyed the League of Nations are almost the same as being used, those being used now by President Bush. The whole real issue is this about the UN. If the inspectors encounter problems, who decides that this is a breach of the UN resolution? President Bush, if he thinks that overflight attacks or attacks on overflights are a breach now, it's going to be the Americans who decide if it's a breach of the UN resolution over weapons inspectors. Or is the UN Security Council resolution allowed to meet again to decide whether a hindrance of the inspectors is a real breach of the UN resolution? But much more seriously than that, I think, is the fact that the UN is once again being used as a little kind of flag. You know, there was UN backing for the 1991 Gulf War. And I was there during that Gulf War, and I never saw a UN flag in the entire military campaign. Even you can't really even call it a campaign. It was a bombardment and a storming in of Kuwait. But it was a liberation of Kuwait, at least. I think the point is with the United Nations, though, that the poor old UN donkey is always brought in the end to clear up the international situation after a war is over. Be sure, if America invades Iraq, and of course there will be some kind of civil war at the same time because there will be massive revenge killings following it, in setting up the new administration, which of course will have to be pro-American because the oil concessions are going to come to the United States, the UN will be asked to give also some kind of imprimatur to that new administration, that new situation which will be produced by war, just as it was after the NATO forces entered Kosovo at the end of the bombardment of Serbia in the 1999 war. So the UN is of use to the United States, but ultimately I think it's going to be the United States that makes the decision of whether or not that UN resolution has been breached. We will see, I think, what happened. Well, we will see very quickly what's going to happen if the UN inspectors don't find any weapons of mass destruction. Because if the United States really intends to invade Iraq, the one nightmare for President Bush would be the discovery that there were no weapons of mass destruction and thus no reason to invade. One of two things then has to happen. Either we have to play up again the crimes against humanity, which indeed have been committed by Saddam Hussein, forgetting, of course, that the United States didn't care the slightest bit about these crimes against humanity when Saddam was invading Iran and America was supporting Saddam. What we're also going to see, that this will be the great test, and watch the front page of the New York Times and Washington Post. If the inspectors don't find weapons of mass destruction, if they are not hindered in their work, I suspect we're going to see stories which begin to hint that the inspectors are not quite up to the job, that they don't really have the abilities or the technical competence to fulfill the job properly. This, in other words, will say, well, the UN, I mean, there obviously are weapons of mass destruction. The UN just can't find them. So the moment the smears began against the UN inspectors, if they do begin, then we'll know America is about to go to war. And then we'll see those stories which we see every day, every day, every day in the New York Times and the Post and the LA Times. The United States government believes XYZ, comma, officials say. Over and over again, officials say, officials say. You know, a few hours ago, I gave a talk here in New York in which I said there should be a newspaper called Officials Say. And a few hours ago, after that, I opened my morning New York Times. Have a look. Officials said, intelligence officials say. It's right there on page one, as usual. Sourcing of any story on the Middle East in the major American newspapers now always has a first paragraph which ends, comma, officials say. So, in other words, the journalists who should be inquiring as to what really is going on in the administration have become mouthpieces, functionaries, fonctionnaires, as the French would say, of the administration. This is a very shameful and sad period for the American media, I think.
Did you hear about the media being trained by the Pentagon now? They're giving them lessons on how to cover war.
Yes. I also remember how the Pentagon called in Hollywood directors after September 11th, 2001, to tell them what was going to happen next. The worst thing is the way in which the American media play along with it. In the 1991 Gulf War, they were hustled into joining these ridiculous pools and putting on military costumes. And the net result of this was that at the end of the war, they all said, this was terrible. The government were covering up. We couldn't see things. There was even an attempt, I believe, I remember, to bring a court case against the American
government. We did that. Exactly. We joined with Independent
Press.
With
others. And in fact, you got mainstream. I'm sorry, I call the New York Times alternative press, but you actually got you had other journalists
press.
Involved. Yeah, but it's all been forgotten. We're now falling into line again.
Well, they didn't join in that,
by the way.
They didn't,
but other news organizations. Yes. I think CNN did it not at the end?
Independent Press brought
the CNN certainly did have some case they were trying to bring. It doesn't matter. But the point is that we have forgotten it all. We have learned nothing. And now the incestuous relationship between the press and television and the administration has been resealed, warmed up again, with no serious voices saying, in terms of the relationship between the press and the administration, hold on, what is going on here? Why does the State Department correspondent always just say what the State Department says?
Robert Fisk, I'm actually looking at a Guardian piece. Forgive me.
I'm taking great exception to that, Amy.
But you're talking about the smears against the UN weapons inspectors.
I'm not seeing this in
U.S. papers, but you can read it for yourself if you would read their words.
I'm quoting the Guardian. This is truly terrible. The United Nations chief weapons inspector, Hans Blix, yesterday accused hawks in Washington, I don't use hawks, who are bent on going to war, of conducting a smear campaign against him. Thank you very much. Well, wait till the New York Times does that, and then you'll know we're in business. We're going to war.
You have covered the Middle East for more than 30 years.
No, more than 26. I haven't quite got the 30 yet. I hope I'll live that long.
Well, I'm very optimistic.
I'm not actually sometimes, but carry on, yeah. I think it's a very dangerous world now.
Well, speaking of dangers, why don't we go back to Afghanistan? Because that seems to be the place that the U.S. is touting as, well, we move from Afghanistan now to Iraq because Afghanistan was a success. You were there. You were beaten up. You covered the bombing of Afghanistan.
I went back in August to Afghanistan. I went back to the same village where I was hurt, actually, and I went back to towns and villages outside Kandahar, which had just been raided by American special forces. And it is not a success, it's a disaster. Afghanistan is now an economic and political and military shambles. The warlords are back, the drugs have restarted, the drug barons are back exporting, the poppy crop is in. The war crimes of our Northern Alliance allies, the asphyxiation in container trucks of 1,000 Taliban opponents have gone uncovered effectively, except by one or two journalists, and there is to be no official investigation. The UN is virtually powerless. There is shooting every night on the streets of Kandahar. You cannot drive at night on the roads of Afghanistan. I remember back last Christmas period, both Colin Powell and our own dear Prime Minister, Tony Blair, announcing, "We will stand by Afghanistan. We will not forget. We will rebuild this country. Much talk of democracy." And we've forgotten about it. Money is going in, not enough. But effectively, the country is regressing back to what it was under the Northern Alliance after the departure of Soviet or then Russian troops in the early part of the previous decade. We're going back to exactly the same period with warlords fighting each other, huge amounts of cash being handed out by the United States Special Forces to, you know, warlords whom they favor or have decided are warlord of the week, who'll do things for them. And the public resentment, I don't like the word public in the sense of Afghanistan, the resentment of ordinary Afghans, which means in many cases poor, starving, uneducated Afghans, is growing. Special forces are finding that for the first time in the villages, villagers are throwing stones at them. And I remember I was in Afghanistan for the Russian invasion. And I remember how, first of all, they announced, the Russian army, that they had they destroyed the terrorist elements. The terrorists, of course, were the Mujahideen fighting with CIA help. Then they announced that Afghanistan was back on its feet. Law and order had been returned. Then Russian soldiers found that villagers were throwing stones at them. Then came the first ambush of the Russians in a valley called Shai Kot, not far from Kandahar. And I went out in 1980 to the scene of that ambush. And that is the very same exact location where the Americans found themselves ambushed by Al-Qaeda in the early part of this year. What is extraordinary now is the way in which the pattern of the Russian invasion is being followed step by step, week by week, by the pattern of the American presence. Russians would start going into villages, old men would get shot, kids would die, they were hunting for terrorists, quote-unquote. I went in August to the village of Haji Belgit outside Kandahar. It's a desert village. It had been raided by American special forces in the company of Afghan special forces, which we haven't actually heard of very much about. Afghan special forces, which are based in the old secret police headquarters in Kabul and which do employ torture. In this village where they were hunting for Al-Qaeda remnants, there are always remnants of Al-Qaeda, when the raid took place, an 86-year-old man who was the village leader, whose name is actually Haji Belgit, the same name as the village, he was shot to death. We don't know who did it, but he was certainly shot in the mosque, and I found bits of his skull on the floor. A little girl of 8 who was frightened of the smoke grenades and the flashbang grenades thrown to frighten the villagers, made in Germany, by the way, I've got some of them, she ran away and fell down a well and was drowned. Her father was among dozens of villagers who were taken by the Americans, handcuffed and put on helicopters. He was not told his daughter was dead. They also put the body of the 86-year-old man on one of the helicopters to take it back to the US base in Kandahar to identify it. Heaven knows, do they think it was bin Laden? In the end, they had to go to the International Red Cross with a photograph of the dead man, asking the Red Cross to find out who he was. Those men were interrogated by US forces with Afghan interpreters, speaking Pashto and English. And after 1 week, the Americans apologized and dumped them back in the sports stadium at Kandahar to find their own way home. That was when the man realized and was told his 8-year-old daughter was dead. And that was when the other men realized that the 86-year-old who was killed was the village leader. In the absence of the menfolk, neighboring villagers came in and looted the village. And it was fairly clear from my own investigations that the neighboring village had told the Americans that Al-Qaeda was just down the road. So this whole raid was carried out. It was a total false raid. It was carried out on the word of villagers who wanted to loot their neighbors. And they did loot them. And now the village of Haji Belgit is virtually undefended. It has virtually ceased to exist. And that is exactly what happened under the Russians.
Robert Fisk of the Independent newspaper. We'll be back with him in a minute.
First world riding high, second world standing by, third world under fire, funny how we all conspire. We don't know 'cause we can't see how such a way could come to be. Riding on a spinning wheel, soon enough will be revealed. Whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this? What kind of world will our children receive? after all is said and done. What kind of creed have we come to believe that they may never be?
Jim Page, Ashes to Ashes, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, as we return to independent reporter Robert Fisk.
I'll be very specific here. I didn't get into the city of Kandahar. I was on my way there when it fell. And what happened was that after pleading and whinging and whining, I got a visa, the very last visa ever issued by the Taliban, ever. I have it in my passport. And it was arranged that I would be taken from the border at Spinbaldak down the main road to Kandahar into the city before it fell. There were five Taliban fighters waiting for me in a vehicle inside Afghanistan at Spinbaldak. And we started driving down the main road towards Kandahar. And after about 20 miles, we came across a village in front of us that was just exploding with bombs. American aircraft so low you could see the pilots. And those huge C-130s that had been converted into gunships that just spit fire down on the ground. Refugees were pouring out of the village. One man was a mullah, sat on the ground and said, they've just killed my brother. I cannot believe it. There are aircraft that pour fire on us. That was his phrase. And I said to the Taliban, there's a road around this village. We can go to the right, turn left, and get back on the main road again. And the Taliban in the driving seat turned to me and he said, we cannot protect ourselves. How can we protect you? And then I realized the Taliban wouldn't go any further. They wouldn't take me to Kandahar. So I never got to the city. But I got to the last major village before the city, and it was clear that it was a rout. It was finished. I don't use World War II metaphors because World War II was a real war. I mean, just appalling compared to this. But everyone was in Stalingrad mode. It was the end. So I watched the end of the Taliban there.
You mentioned drugs, poppy, in Afghanistan. The U.S. is using national security as an excuse to give millions, more than $1 billion, to Colombia, saying it threatens national security just by growing the drugs that are used here in the United States. Yet Afghanistan, it's touting as a success. Can you explain the extent of the drug production right now?
Well, one problem we don't know at the moment is how many of the poppy fields have totally been reconstituted and how many have not. What happened is that basically the biggest drug exporters in the world on a freelance basis was Afghanistan under the Northern Alliance. Now, we all said when the Northern Alliance were chosen as our new allies that the drugs would come back. Tony Blair was putting it around that the Taliban had vast hordes of drugs which they were selling to make money. Well, the Taliban were the only organization, I have no time for the Taliban, but they were the only organization in Afghanistan ever that actually banned drugs in the areas they controlled. And the United Nations specifically said, before the American bombardment last year, that in large areas of Afghanistan there was no more poppy growing. Well, there sure is now. The war, the drug barons, who are effectively the Northern Alliance, I mean, General Dostum, one of our heroes of the Northern Alliance, is one of the biggest drug barons in Afghanistan. He is the guy. You know, we name the guilty man. But part of the price for the war on terror is that our allies are allowed to do what they want. They can keep their guns. They can be paid in dollars. They can grow drugs, grow poppies. They can fight each other, providing they don't disturb the central government of Mr. Karzai too much. Again and again, Karzai is asking for international forces to control the whole country, which will put an end to the drugs trade. But it's been made clear by the Pentagon that this will not be appropriate. And I can well see why. Because the moment that the Americans turn and try to close down the new drugs export capacity of Afghanistan, they'll be fighting all their allies. And that they will not want to do because they still want to retain these people for, quote, the war on terror, unquote. So the drugs are on their way. The latest UN report that came out 2.5 months ago said that one of the largest poppy crops is now underway in Afghanistan. You can see them, by the way. I mean, you can drive off the road and see the poppy fields and walk right through them. They really are there, all poppies, and they're coloured too.
Robert Fisk, you were beaten up by villagers in Afghanistan. Can you describe what happened, how you wrote about it, and the response to that?
Well, it was actually an Afghan refugee village a few kilometres on the Pakistani side of the Afghan border. What had happened, this was the same period I was getting into Kandahar province, is that the American bombing, particularly on the western side of Kandahar, was leaving lots of civilians dead. CNN was calling it collateral damage, as usual, but they were killing lots of families. And refugees had arrived from Kandahar most of them having lost their loved ones in the bombing raids. And they turned up at a village called Kila Abdullah, a strongly Taliban community. These men came in shocked, outraged, mourning the loss of their loved ones, who we killed, of course, at the West. They were not killed by the Taliban. And I was driving down the main road en route to Kandahar province, and my car broke down in the village of Kila Abdullah. I was with, I had an interpreter, because I don't speak Pashto. I had a Pashtun Pakistani driver, and my own colleague, our Prague correspondent, who had been seconded into Afghanistan, Justin Hugler, who's a good personal friend of mine as well. Car broke down, and a lot of hooting. The car was blocking the main road. We got out to help push it to the side of the road. And for a few seconds, people were very friendly. You know, the salamu alaikum, we were shaking hands. And then, as we walked round beside the car, a little tiny pebble went past my ear and bounced off Justin's shoulder. And once a stone is thrown in Afghanistan, you're in trouble. And I remember the way in which Justin looked over his left shoulder at me with a look of deep concern in his eyes. And the next thing, a kid came up and tried to pull my satchel away from me. I carry a kind of school satchel in tough countries to carry my passport, money, credit cards, contacts book. And he hung on to it, and I pulled it away, and then he kicked me in the shin and then punched me, just a little boy, on the shoulder. I walked round in front of the back of the car into the centre of the road. I said, let's get away from the crowd. But the crowd followed like a sort of giant amoeba. Justin was just in front of me, and there was a bus pointing in the direction of the Pakistani regional capital of Quetta, and the driver was motioning to us to get on the bus. Justin got on, I was following him on, and then the kid again grabbed my satchel and three other men and pulled me off the bus, and I wouldn't let the satchel go. I had all my money, my passport, my contacts book, for God's sakes. And as I was pulled off the bus, a number of young men of 18, 19 came up with big rocks in their hand and smashed them into my face and the top of my head. My glasses were smashed. I remember thinking that when I was at school once, I got beaten by a boy with a stone, and it was very similar. But here there were a lot. There were about 10 or 11. Some of the stones were bouncing off the top of my head. Others, they were literally coming up with a rock in their hand and banging it into my face and my forehead and the top of my head. And I remember for a moment, Justin was looking at me from the bus with a look of horror, and I was saying, help me, and he was trying to pull me, and I was torn from his arm, from his hand. And it went on, and for 15 minutes, almost 15 minutes in all, and there were about, at the end, about 50 men there. And I was beginning to lose ability to judge what was happening because I had so much blood in my eyes. I didn't realize at first my glasses were broken. And at one point, I looked into the side of the bus. You know, it was a shiny metal side to the bus. And I saw myself just covered in blood and gore from head to foot. I looked like, you know, Macbeth laced in his blood. And only then I realized, you know, how badly hurt, and they were going to kill me. This was obviously an attempt to kill me. I remember seeing two young men with beards running up with wolfish smiles. They were excited at the idea of a person covered in blood, very animal-like. And then two thoughts came in my mind. The first was, how long does it take to die? And then I remembered what a Lebanese had told me during the Lebanese War, and that is, whatever you do, don't do nothing. And so I decided very coldly, I knew exactly what was happening, I knew they were trying to kill me, it hurt. I kept having to put my fingers in my eyes because there was a sort of sucking sound to get the blood out so I could see. So I decided to attack the nearest young men with rocks. I broke one guy's nose, I remember I punched him in the face, and I felt his nose collapse underneath. I hit another man in the mouth, that's the mark of his tooth, which I knocked out. I missed one guy completely because I had too much blood. He was there and I was hitting the wrong direction. And then I knocked a younger man over and he fell on the road. I remember he fell onto some of my blood because I was dripping blood all over the road. And at that moment, the crowd of men moved back. They didn't expect this creature to suddenly fight them. And I half ran but half walked back into the center of the road, at which point a man in a turban, obviously a religious man of some kind, took me by my right arm and started to lead me away. And I couldn't see him very clearly because of the blood in my eyes, but I could feel him leading me away. And I noticed that the stones were smaller and they were skittering along the road by my feet. They weren't hitting me because they didn't want to hit him. He took me to a Pakistani police truck where the policemen refused to help. They had rifles, but they were too frightened of the crowd. Eventually, they were persuaded to take me a few 100 metres down the road, where by extraordinary good fortune there was a Red Cross convoy heading for Quetta. Whether that convoy had passed me while I was being beaten or not, I'm not sure, but I wasn't going to ask. The doctors insisted that I lay on the floor of the vehicle so that the crowd who were coming up the road towards them couldn't drag me out, and they started trying to wash the blood off me and put the first bandages on my face to try and staunch the blood from particularly the top of my head. And here you can still see there's a sort of the wrong markings on my forehead where the biggest rock hit me. And then we drove away, and I realized I was going to be, I was going to live. I didn't feel I wanted to at that time. It was pretty painful. But I realized at once that when I got to Quetta, where there were many journalists, they were going to write about it. Of course, what happened to me was infinitesimally tiny compared to the suffering that Afghans were going through, but they would write about it. So I decided that I'd make it clear that there must be a context in which this story was told. The context was that these people had lost their loved ones. And I wrote the story that night, which went, in fact, all over the front page of our story the next day, with a pretty grim-looking picture of me. And what I said in the story was that, you know, you must remember that these people, who were victims of the whole world, who were abandoned by us, we've killed their loved ones, and I became for them the representative of the killers. And that had I been them, uneducated, not having any idea who I was, I would have done the same to Robert Fisk. I think when people are deeply grieved by violence and the violent death of the loved ones, they're violent. Of course they are. They hit back. And they were hitting back at me as a representative of the armed forces of your president, I guess, and the armed forces of my prime minister. So I wrote a story in which I made it clear that, you know, it was wrong to beat up people in the street, but that in these circumstances I understood. The reaction was to this was very interesting, because on the one hand, a very large number of readers of The Independent wrote very sympathetically. I got a lot of nice letters at Christmas. I also got a number of Christmas cards which were anonymous, saying that it's a pity the Afghans hadn't finished the job. Literally those words. And then in the Wall Street Journal, Mark Stein wrote a column effectively saying the same thing, that he made a number of factual inaccuracies, like saying, you know, my colleagues who were killed were killed by the Taliban, when in fact in most cases they were killed by thieves taking advantage of the Taliban's defeat. And he then went on to suggest that my response to what happened to me meant that I in some way approved of the international crimes against humanity which occurred on September 11th, 2001, which of course was a lie. The headline to the Wall Street Journal story was Hate Me Crimes, which I thought told you a lot about the American media. It was very interesting and sad that much later, when Daniel Pearl was kidnapped very cruelly in Karachi, some reporters in the Wall Street Journal asked me to join in an appeal to save his life. This is the newspaper which said that I virtually deserved almost to be beaten to death, and I would have died if I hadn't fought back. There's a double edge of irony here in that when I got back to Islamabad with bandages all over me, the people who were most kind to me was Daniel Pearl and his wife, who were staying in the same villa, which we use villas rather than hotels in Pakistan. And he was the first person to come up to me and say, do I need another doctor? Do I need anything? And he and his wife, Marianne, took me to they had a sort of apartment in the villa, and they were giving me food and coffee. And because I'd lost my contacts book, Daniel Pearl went through his contacts book and gave me all the numbers he possibly could, and so did his wife, to try and start a new contacts book off. It's sad to recall that some months earlier, before Daniel was kidnapped, his father, Professor Judea Pearl of UCLA, wrote a very brutal and cruel email to my editor about me. I've never discussed this with him, I've never met him, but I mourn with him the death of his very brave son. I remember saying to Daniel at that time, are you going to Afghanistan? Because, of course, at this moment, Afghanistan was in the hands virtually of the Northern Alliance. He said, no, because my wife is pregnant. I don't want to take that risk. In fact, what happened after I was telephoned by the Wall Street Journal correspondent, who was actually in Saudi Arabia at that time, we didn't know it, but Daniel was already dead. He'd already been murdered. My reaction was that I thought my name would be of no use on any petition put in by the Wall Street Journal reporters. I didn't think Osama bin Laden, if he was responsible, was going to care very much about the Wall Street Journal. But I did write a feature article in my newspaper in which I specifically addressed it to Osama bin Laden and said that he should do everything he could to save the life of Daniel Pearl. Because I've met bin Laden, I could do that. The Wall Street Journal could not address Osama bin Laden. But he was already dead by that stage. We didn't know it. So it was useless, of course.
You're listening to Robert Fisk of the Independent newspaper, voted best foreign correspondent by reporters and editors for many years. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, which we'll continue with after a break, call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Back in a minute.
For a light out of the dim, the first thing I heard that made sense was the word of Muhammad, peace be upon him. I shall do La ilaha illallah. There's no God but God if my daddy could see me now. Chains around my feet. You don't understand. Sometimes a man's got to find.
Steve Earle, John Walker's Blues here on Democracy Now! As we return now to Robert Fisk of the Independent newspaper.
Well, I guess more than I realized, I'm probably influenced today by the fact that my father, who was much older than my mother, was a soldier in the First World War. He fought in the Third Battle of Arras in 1918. He took a camera to the trenches. I have the photograph of him. He actually raised a camera at one point over no man's land, took two pictures, and brought the camera down before the Germans fired. And I've got a photograph of, you know, those dead trees, sandbags, the wasteland that you've seen in pictures of the First War. I've got Second Lieutenant Bill Fisk's own photographs of it. And I've actually, the other day, I went and found the very house where he spent the first night of peace on the night of the 11th of November 1918. And I also have his campaign medal, on the back of which is written, The Great War for Civilization. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? But what I've been very struck by is that in 17 months following that great war, 1914-1918, in the years of 1920 and 1921, in the space of just 17 months, the victors of that war created the borders of Northern Ireland and Yugoslavia and the Middle East. And I started my professional career in Northern Ireland, in Belfast, living there. And I've covered the Yugoslav War, and I've spent almost half my life in the Middle East. So I've spent virtually my entire professional career watching those same borders burn and the people inside them burn. And of course, and I think probably this is what my book is about now in retrospect, though I didn't realize when I wrote it, we all live under the malign curse of history of what our fathers and grandfathers did and what they decided. You know, after the First World War, President Woodrow Wilson, I mean, your country was the great peacemaker after the First World War. We Brits and the French were still ready to go to war with other people again. It was completely reversed position to what it is today. And I've always been very struck by the fact that my father's generation cursed us all. And cursed me in Beirut, too. And the difficulty of breaking free from history, it just seems impossible. Very difficult to do.
Yugoslavia. The Middle East, Northern Ireland.
Mm.
Pity the Nation, The Abduction of Lebanon is the name of your book. It is a tome. Why did you call it The Abduction of Lebanon?
Well, I should tell you, I have some very cruel friends who say Pity the Reader is the title of the book. I don't go along with that. This is the original title of the book. The book is very much about suicide bombing, the very first suicide bombers. I mean, there is a very appalling and chilling relevance now from September the 11th to that book, which wasn't when I originally wrote it. It was because the power of the superpowers in the Middle East, and I'm talking about originally Britain and France and now America, is so great that we basically have hijacked the Middle East. We hijack it for oil, we hijack it for political interests, we hijack it because of the interests which we feel we want to look after over the Israelis. Originally, of course, the British were keen on hijacking it because it was not only full of oil, it was also our way out to the India of the British Empire. And after all, when originally after the First World War, all these countries were supposed to be independent, but the French created the artificial state of Lebanon. Out of Syria, there wasn't a Lebanese state until 1919, 1920. So it seemed to me that in a country where the abduction of Westerners, Terry Anderson, Terry Waite, etc., an abduction period when I was on the run living in West Beirut, because I stayed there during that period, it seemed to me that the abduction of Lebanon as a country symbolized the way in which individual Westerners were, in return, if you like, physically abducted by kidnappers of Islamic Jihad and the various Muslim groups who took them. In the case of Terry Anderson, for almost 7 years in underground dungeons.
You were a good friend of his.
Yeah, I remain so. We talk to each other on the phone still from time to time. Fisky! Terry, I'll come down the phone. What are you still doing in Beirut? You know? But Terry is a happy man now. Not all the hostages are happy. I think some were very deeply affected by what happened to them. But Terry, of course, was a tough ex-Marine. I remember when the AP, the head of AP, Louis Bacardi, was wondering if he was going to come out. I was here in New York, and I was talking to Louis Bacardi, and he said, we're all very worried about how Terry will be, you know, psychologically. And I said, look, I've traveled with Terry under gunfire many times in Lebanon. He's a Marine. Forget it. He'll be okay. And in fact, I was there the minute of his release, and he said, Fisky, how are you? And I said, Terry, you haven't changed. He said, no, of course not. He said, time stopped 7 years ago. No? Extraordinary. But that was how it got its name. In England, the edition is called Pity the Nation, Lebanon at War, because there's a tradition in British publishing that you can't have two metaphorical titles to the same book. Pity the Nation is a quotation from the great Lebanese poet Khalil Gibran. It's a very ironic poem about Lebanon. And the abduction of Lebanon, of course, is a metaphor. So in British publishing, they like to have the metaphor in the first part of the title, and the second bit tells you what the book's about. Normally, I'd expect it to be the other way around, and it'd be the Americans who'd want the simple title, but it's not. You've got the better title, I think.
You want to read the Khalil Gibran?
I think you
poem?
Should read Khalil Gibran's poem. I've read it too many times. I wouldn't get it right. It's better from someone who hasn't read it before.
Pity the nation that is full of beliefs and empty of religion. Pity the nation that wears a cloth that does not weave, eats a bread it does not harvest, and drinks a wine that flows not from its own wine press. Pity the nation that acclaims the bully as hero and that deems the glittering conqueror bountiful. Pity the nation that despises a passion in its dream, yet submits in its awakening. Pity the nation that raises not its voice, save when it walks in a funeral, boasts not except among the ruins, and will rebel not save when its neck is laid between the sword and the block. Pity the nation whose statesman is a fox, whose philosopher is a juggler, and whose art is the art of patching and mimicking. Pity the nation that welcomes its new ruler with trumpetings and farewells him with hootings, only to welcome another with trumpetings again. Pity the nation whose sages are dumb with years and whose strong men are yet in the cradle. Pity the nation divided into fragments, each fragment deeming itself a nation.
And believe me, if the Americans invade Iraq and Saddam goes, the Iraqis will be hooting with laughter at Saddam's departure. And they will be loving the Americans when they first arrive, after which all the tables will turn over again. Very accurate poem for almost anywhere in the Middle East. Actually, the only other poem, which I'm going to use in my next book, which fits the Middle East, and particularly Iraq, is the great poem by Auden about the dictator. I'll try and get it right. Perfection of a kind is what he was after, and the poetry he invented was easy to understand. He was greatly interested in armies and fleets, and he knew human folly like the back of his hand. When he laughed, respectable senators burst into laughter, and when he cried, the little children died in the streets. I'm going to use that Auden poem in my next book.
What are you going to write about?
Well, I've got to start on January 31st, and I'm supposed to finish on August 31st next year. And of course it'll be delayed if I have to follow Mr. Bush's Iraqi adventure. It's going to be really a book about the whole of the Middle East, from Afghanistan to Algeria. I'm not going to go into Yugoslavia, it's too different. It's going to include the Iran-Iraq War, the Gulf War, September 11th, of course. But I'm not going to write it. This is written chronologically. It's a story, it's a tragic adventure story of people and journalists. It's also a story about journalists, and so will the new book be. It'll be about reporting, my colleagues, me, the black jokes we have to make clinging to helicopters over battlefields and so on. It'll be a powerful story, and it'll be a story of great tragedy, even greater than this. But I'm not going to make it chronological, because it's going to be like, you know, chapter 3, it must be Algeria. It's not going to work. So what I'm planning to do is to start with my talking to Osama bin Laden a few years ago on a mountaintop in Afghanistan, then go back to the Russian invasion, then go forward to Algeria, and at one point I'll go right back to my father in the Battle of the Somme. So, and it'll be about history and the malign curse of history, and it will show that curse on ordinary people and on us, and it'll have the same cruel, I suspect, questioning of our job as journalists. The reporters will be very much there by name, themselves, in their characters. And Terry Anderson is in here as a real three-dimensional character, complete with all his flaws and his dusty glasses. He took his revenge, by the way, on me. And when he wrote his own book of memories of Lebanon and being a hostage, he always said that I always wore mismatching socks and had fingerprints on my glasses, which I feel is probably accurate. And I was pretty. I always said he had piggy eyes behind his spectacles. You see. But it'll be a book with humour too, very black humour, as I think Pity the Nation has quite a lot of. But it'll be a book that I'll never be able to write another book like this once I've written it.
You have covered Israel and the occupied territories extensively, even done a film on
them. And it'll
them.
Be in the book too, yeah.
You've been pilloried for that reporting, particularly here in the United States. Can you convey to us just briefly what you think is the most important thing to understand about the occupation?
That it's an occupation. That it's an occupation. That's the most important thing to understand. The problem is that so much of the reporting suggests by inference that it isn't an occupation. Just as the State Department put out a memo, Colin Powell did, to US embassies, don't talk about the occupied territories, talk about disputed territories. CNN has actually issued an actual memorandum saying that the settlement of Gilo should be called a neighborhood. This is the decontextualization I was talking to you about at the beginning of the program. And what's happened is that the fact of the occupation has effectively been deleted from the narrative of the Middle East as it's told in the United States. So the Palestinians who resist this occupation, often most wickedly, I mean, I believe that suicide bombing is an evil deed, but the Palestinians who resist the occupation, because the occupation as a fact is simply deleted from the narrative, they appear to be just mindless, violent people. And thus, it is possible to represent Israel as itself being in a state of sort of occupation. But in fact, Palestinian tanks are not on the streets of Haifa and Tel Aviv. It is Israeli tanks that are on the streets of Hebron and Ramallah. And I think that settlements is an issue. The whole issue that between, for example, the 1993 Oslo Agreement and now, in 93 there were 200,000 Jewish settlers living in settlements for Jews and Jews only on Arab land. Now there are 400,000. That is also deleted from the narrative. I noticed a few days ago, Izzy Asper, one of the big moguls of the Canadian press, published an extraordinary article based upon actually a speech he gave to an Israeli group in Canada, saying that the press were lily-livered, lazy, gutless, cowardly, and anti-Semitic. That we were. Not once in this long speech does he mention the occupation or the settlements. Because one of the things that's happening more and more now is that Israel supporters and Israel's friends, and don't think for a moment, by the way, that the Arabs aren't capable of cursing us. I get plenty of problems from Arab regimes. But Israel's friends are increasingly using the disgusting and vile slander of anti-Semitism against perfectly innocent and decent reporters who dare to criticize Israel. And in many places, and I fear the United States is included, rather than confront this disgusting accusation, journalists prefer to avoid it by using the weasel words that will prevent them getting criticized by Israel's friends or perhaps even members of the U.S. administration.
What about the Israeli press?
Thank God for the Israeli press. Thank God for the Israeli press. In my talks, and not only there, but in my newspaper, I constantly say, you've got to read the Israeli press if you really want to know what's going on in the Middle East. Amira Haas, the most courageous of reporters, one of my great heroines in journalism, who writes for Haaretz, and if you don't read Haaretz, you should. Gideon Levy in the same newspaper. Amos Oz, though his views are somewhat different. All these are Israeli writers who put American journalists to shame. I'll give you a perfect example of what I mean. The autocensure, the sort of self-censorship, which the French often talk about. I was in Ireland on my way to give a lecture in America about 4 years ago. And in the Irish Sunday newspaper, the Sunday Tribune, which is a serious broadsheet newspaper, there was a long article from, I think it was either Yediot Aharonot or from Haaretz, written by a former Israeli soldier talking about Kana when he went into Kana in 82 as a soldier of the occupation army, I mean long before the Kana massacre of 96, talking about how they treated the villagers, pushed them around, and how they looted cars. Very brave article from a former IDF soldier. When I reached New York, the plane stopped over in New York, and then I had to change and go on to the West Coast. And I picked up the New York Times, and I saw the same story. And I just noticed, you know, I have a kind of sub-editor's eye, because long, long ago on the Sunday Express, I used to set type. And I realized it wasn't quite the same length as the Sunday Tribune article. It was the same article, same byline, same newspaper, Haaretz or Yediot Ahronoth, whichever it was. And I tracked through very carefully. I read it all. And the bit about the looting of the cars had been deleted from the New York Times. The Americans had to have an Israeli report censored. Absolutely astonishing.
You've had your own report censored here.
Well, now, yes, not that I knew about it until one of our readers were very kind enough to tell me. It wasn't in the United States, it was in Canada. What happened was that I do a large number of articles about the Armenian genocide, which we call the Armenian Holocaust, and we use a capital H about the genocide, the killing of 1.5 million Armenians by the Turks in the First World War, as we do use a capital H, of course, about the murder of 6 million Jews in the Second World War. And the Toronto Globe and Mail, which sometimes takes our syndicated press service, ran an article I wrote last year in which I referred to the Armenian Holocaust. In the article, as they printed it, Holocaust had been deleted and replaced by the killing of thousands of Armenians. In other words, again, they had deleted the reality of 1.5 million dead and turned it into ethnic cleansing. What made it even more outrageous is that the Toronto... I got on from Beirut immediately. I heard from an Armenian in Toronto who wrote to me. I got onto our syndication department and said, hang on a minute, under our syndication rules, anyone who changes the words has to pay a very large penalty fee. They have to pay in cash for censoring copy. Not only did it turn out they'd changed the copy, they'd stolen it. They never even paid us for the article originally. So first the Toronto Globe and Mail nicked my article, then they changed it and kept my byline. So they had to pay up a lot of money to the Independent. I'm glad to say they deserve it.
September 11th, where were you?
I was on an aeroplane crossing the Atlantic heading in your direction, Amy. Of course, the plane turned round. I knew when I was taking off from Brussels, actually. I was on a Sabena flight. Sabena went bankrupt as a result, and I still haven't got my ticket money back I should have. But anyway, I was on a flight out of there, and I was just going into the plane, and my mobile phone rang, and I stepped back from the aircraft. We're more strict than you are about using mobile phones before takeoff. And it was my features editor. I actually had a huge expose on Sabra and Shatila and what had actually happened running on the night of September the 11th. It didn't run that night, of course. And the features editor called me up and said, Robert, there's been a light aircraft flown into the World Trade Center. Oddly enough, I think he said the Free Trade Center, but, you know, the news was coming in. So I kept the phone on. I told the crew something odd was happening in New York. And then the phone rang again. They said there are now two aircraft, and they appear to be passenger aircraft. So I said immediately, this is not a mistake. This is something terrible. And then the next report came in from the phone that there was a helicopter that had hit the Pentagon. That was the very first agency report before, again, we knew it was an airliner. And I actually went down because I knew some of the crew. And I talked to the captain. I said, you better know what's going on. I told him. And he was given clearance for takeoff for New York. So off we took. And he was talking to Brussels ground control, saying, what do you know? What do you know? And I was actually standing with the crew at the front of the aircraft as we were flying and talking to them and discussing what this meant. And obviously, as air crew, they had an extraordinary feeling of compassion for the air crews in these planes. And then Brussels control came on and said, there's another plane gone down. And the pilot came out, you know, we had a co-pilot there, and we were talking about it. I said, you know, you're never going to get to New York. Unless they're insane, the Americans will shut down every East Coast, which they did, of course. And over the Atlantic, we were ordered to turn round. And I then used the satellite, airline satellite phone, which is in the seat beside me in the aircraft, to call London. And I said, look, I'm writing, it's all right, don't worry. And they said, God damn it, we hoped you'd get to New York so you could get down to Manhattan. They wanted me to reach here and to JFK. And so I said, well, look, all right. So I was going to sit down and write by hand, of course, the story I wanted to tell. You know, why has this happened? Bin Laden's probably responsible. How could the Middle East produce this? I was sure this was Arabs. I was sure it was a Middle East story. And I decided that instead of writing it down, I'd just write out the first paragraph, so it has come to this. And then I'd speak to the copy taker and read my mind over. That story was not actually written down. I dictated out of my head. And I got London. I was, of course, over the Atlantic on a satellite phone. I got London to patch me into our copy taker in Manchester, England. This is a lady who's sitting there with earphones and a sort of laptop in front of her. And I just talked into the telephone in sentences and wrote my story without changing anything. And I talked about the history of deceit and lies in the Middle East and the humiliation of the Arabs, that I thought bin Laden was responsible for this.
You'd interviewed him three times.
Already, yes. And the last time I interviewed him, I remembered, and I recalled in this article, the last time he saw me, I was on a mountaintop in one of his camps in Afghanistan. And he said, "From this mountain upon which you're sitting, Mr. Robert, we defeated the Russian army and helped to break the Soviet Union," which is probably partly true. And then he went on and said, "And Mr. Robert, I pray that God permits us to turn America into a shadow of itself." And you know, when I got back to Brussels and saw the pictures on television of the Twin Towers coming down in that sort of biblical tower collapse, I thought, my goodness, New York now looks like a shadow of itself. But I wrote that story, 750 words from the plane, and we printed it next morning in the paper, because I was trying to answer the why question. And I wrote in that story that in the days and weeks and months to come, great efforts will be made to prevent us asking why. And they were great efforts. It was the one question you weren't allowed to ask. And I had abuse heaped on me in emails, letters, phone calls.
Weren't you already debating someone that night on radio?
Well, that night I ended up with a well-known Boston professor, of course, Dershowitz.
And Alan Dershowitz.
Yes, and he was shouting down the phone at me that I was a dangerous man, I was an anti-American, whatever that is, that to be anti-American was the same as to be anti-Semitic. In other words, to criticize America in any form in the Middle East meant that I was a Jew-hater, a Nazi, a racist. Of course, I got the point. In other words, it was to shut down, to close down. Here was a professor at a major university trying to close down serious discussion about an international crime against humanity. And the point I made over and over again is, look, whenever there's a crime on the streets of New York, the first thing the cops do is look for a motive. And here is a catastrophic international crime against humanity, and the one thing we are not allowed to do is look for a motive. And I thought this was utterly illogical. It was unworthy of any academic to make such a comment, although I notice that the same narrative that to merely question any reasons that lay behind the perversion of morality that these killers encompassed was to be pro-terrorist. You were supporting international terrorism the moment you asked the question. We were given the narrative to believe they hated us because we're good, because we're democratic, even though most of these guys wouldn't know what democracy was if it got into bed with them. This was the narrative set down by the US administration and President Bush. And anyone who deviated from this, anyone who said, hang on a minute, you know, what happened in the Middle East to produce this society? It was perfectly all right for us to know that they were Arabs. It was perfectly all right to know that they were Muslims, or claim they were Muslims. It was perfectly all right for us to know that, you know, 15 of them came from Saudi Arabia, one came from Egypt, one came from Lebanon. But the moment you turned around to look at the place they came from, called the Arab Middle East, there was a problem. No, no, don't look too carefully there, because the moment you try to look at that, you have to ask about American foreign policy in the Middle East. What have we done to them? History, the First World War, the Treaty of Versailles, all those frontiers that my father's generation created. You have to say, well, what's America's relations with the Arabs? What's its relations with Israel? Why? And that is a subject which has been discussed. Edward Said himself has said it is the last taboo. In America, you can talk about gays, blacks, lesbians. There's nothing you can't talk about, but not America's relationship with the Middle East. Any serious discussion there must be closed down. And Alan Dershowitz is part of the machinery. He may not know it, part of the machinery to close down that discussion.
And you've been listening to Robert Fisk. He is the Middle East correspondent for The Independent, the daily newspaper of Britain, based in Beirut for the last 26 years. Been voted best foreign correspondent by British editors and reporters for many years. If you'd like to order a video cassette or audio cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer and music maestro, assisted by Rich Kim. Our website is www.democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. Our email address, mail, mail, at democracynow.org. As we go out with Jim Page, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Because we can't see how such a way could come to be. Riding on a spinning wheel.